When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Temporary Admission. This week we're joined by not one, but two guests as we take our artist spotlights up a notch. So I'm currently sat here with London-based artist and Royal Academician Rana Begum, and the architect behind her new home and studio, and founder of Spatial Affairs, Peter Cully. Thank you very much for joining us today, guys.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Yeah, it's nice to hear from you, James.
No problem. Well, it's our pleasure. And look, Rana, why don't we start with you, because I think our conversation might make a little bit more sense if we do so. But are you able to tell us a little bit more about you and your practice? Because I don't know about Peter, but it does seem that everywhere I look, your name seems to be popping up at the moment, whether it's, you know, VRA or in your exhibition at Christie Roberts or whatever it may be. It just seems to be Rana Begum popping up all over London. So it'd be good to know a little bit more about you.
Yes. There's quite a few things going on in London. They started a while ago and things have just kind of come together at the same time. So the last few months have been quite busy here in the studio. So my work, I would say, I describe myself as a visual artist, and I work with various different kind of materials, and my work kind of stems from painting, sculpture and architecture. And I like working in a three-dimensional way, and I use a lot of colour.
I think it's the colour as well that really attracted me to your work in the first instance. But I'm interested, how was it that you got into being an artist, and what was that process like for you?
I mean, the way I got into art was because when I first arrived to the UK, I think I was around 8 years old, and I had, you know, I couldn't speak English, I couldn't read or write English, and so it took me a long time to really grasp the language. So I would spend, you know, I had amazing teachers that basically gave me lots of pencils and paper, and I ended up just drawing daily, drawing what my life was like growing up in Bangladesh and drawing things, you know, here. And I think it was a way of communicating, and it really allowed me to actually interact with my peer and my teachers. And that's how it started. And then I've continued to have amazing support throughout school and university, and continue to have encouragement. And yeah, so yeah, I mean, it wasn't easy growing up as an artist and being a Muslim female artist. Usually, you know, at a certain age, you know, you go through arranged marriage and you have kids, and you don't, women, it's really difficult for women to have careers, and particularly in art as well. It took a little bit of work to convince my parents to let me study art. And when I did, I mean, my father was amazing. I remember actually applying for my degree at Chelsea and just freaking out and not knowing how I was going to take my work to the interview. And, you know, my father kind of surprised me by hiring, you know, a man with a van, basically. And I was able to go to my interview with so much work that actually it didn't fit into the interview room. I had to ask the panel to come out and look at the work. And I remember actually them saying, you know, why aren't you doing architecture? And I remember saying, actually, art gave me a lot more freedom.
I think what's so interesting there is that actually the Royal Academy spotted that link to architecture within your work, I guess, so early on. And you've now been quite heavily involved with the summer exhibition, which obviously we spoke about slightly earlier with Axel Ruger in a previous episode, but you worked on the two architecture rooms there, didn't you, this year?
Yeah, so Alison Wilding is this year's coordinator, and I was one of the artists that was selected to do one of the rooms. And Neil McLaughlin was the architect selected to do the architecture room. And when Alison was actually talking about the theme of this year's summer exhibition, which is climate, both Neil and I immediately thought about Marina Tabassum, and so we were very excited and wanted to kind of bring her on board for the project. And actually, after the meeting, Neil and I continued to have a conversation, and Neil suggested that we collaborate. So we brought our rooms together and merged kind of art and architecture together, if you like. And it was good. It was really interesting. And I think it gave us a bit more, you know, kind of conversation in terms of the way we should really be thinking about climate.
And I guess we should just point out at this point that for those of you that haven't had a chance to listen to our previous episode, the theme of the summer exhibition at the Royal Academy this year is climate. But Rona, what did those two rooms look like, or what can our listeners expect if they were able to go and have a look inside?
There are two rooms which are kind of painted kind of this dark, kind of dark blue, and there are three large scale works. And one of them is Marina's house that could be dismantled and assembled again and kind of relocated depending on the water level, right? And it's incredible. It's this structure, and actually, you know, at the moment it's the monsoon season, and obviously there's been a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of deaths and because of the flooding and everything. So it's actually there and being used currently as well. And so it was really important for us to kind of really bring to forefront, you know, how architecture can be used to kind of help resolve issues with climate change. And then you've got Boonson, who are looking at material, and they're using elephant dung to create this beautiful structure in the space. And the other is Webb Yates and the stonemasoners are working together to deal with climate crisis in a different way, kind of almost kind of a preventative way, and how we can use materials that already exist. We, you know, how we can minimize the impact on our planet by using materials that is much more available. So not using concrete or steel to build structures. So their structure kind of runs through, you know, one of the room.
I think that's one of the things that's quite nice about the summer exhibition, though, is that there's so many voices coming together to kind of share different ideas or, you know, different approaches on different topics.
Yeah, there is. And, you know, and the other thing is obviously the art. And there are invited artists like Rashid Areen, Laura Gannon, Nathaniel Racco, and Alex Garibaldi, and Ben Rivers, and Simran Gill. So they're kind of international group of artists that have been invited, also asked to apply. And, you know, the art was really important, that there was conversations happening in the space between the artwork, between the models, between films, you know, so there's lots of different medium. And I think, you know, I like the idea that people are able to walk through and see the connections, see the conversations that are happening in regards to climate change.
I think one thing that's quite interesting, and honestly, Peter, don't worry, we will get to the crux of architecture soon, I'm sure. But I'm just interested, just whilst we're on the topic of the Royal Academy, Rana, it feels like a lot of institutions, I mean, maybe the ones that we've spoken to specifically, are running exhibitions on climate at the moment. I mean, we've had the Barbican run the Our Time on Earth exhibition, which obviously we sat down and chatted about a little bit earlier in the season. And We've also got, you know, the summer exhibition at the RA, and there's a lot going on around the conversation of climate, which is obviously, you know, a good thing. But how effective do you think it is, or how do you think the Royal Academy have been successful in tackling their theme as climate? Because they've done it a bit differently, and I think, you know, to their success actually, maybe, around focusing on climate and then, you know, in terms of the environment, but then climate more broadly.
Oh, as an institute, I think that would be for Axel to actually respond to that. But I think, you know, I think what's good is that it's at the forefront of everyone's agenda to tackle, to address the issue. And I think Royal Academy is doing, as you know, I think is part of that process. But I think what's really good is that a lot of effort is being made. I don't know if it's necessarily if all the right things are being done, but I know from meetings and so forth, you know, all the RAs are definitely pushing for changes to be made.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you on that, because I think from our conversations with Axel, and I think not all of it was mentioned on the podcast, but there's definitely a lot being done behind the scenes on, you know, how exhibitions can operate more sustainably, and actually, you know, how institutions as well are holding themselves actually to an account in more cases. And that was also the case with the Barbican as well, you know, launching their own environmental plan and having that in place. So I think that's definitely been successful. But I think it's also quite nice with the Royal Academy, and we touched on it slightly earlier, around the idea of bringing in those different voices, and actually by the Royal Academy being able to do that, they're approaching climate in quite a different way, because you're allowed to or able to see different aspects or different thought processes on how you can tackle kind of the same matter. And I think that's quite powerful.
Yeah, I think, you know, the great thing about the summer exhibition is that, you know, the voices that you're hearing isn't the voices that you always hear. You know, you've got certain you know, caliber of artists that you're always seeing, and you know, my name included, you know, you're always seeing and you're always hearing. But what's great about the summer exhibition is that actually the voices come from all over UK, and in some cases internationally. And what's really wonderful is that you know, you're able to bring this under one roof. You know, I don't think any other institute is able to do that in the same way. And I think that's, you know, I think it's so important, and especially, you know, for Neil and I, when we worked together on the two rooms, it was so important for us to kind of be hopeful and look at solutions. And yes, there are some architects that have submitted models and drawings that really doesn't reflect what needs to happen. But there are also architects that are working, and engineers and designers and artists that are working and are trying to shift things. And I think that's where our focus was, and we wanted to kind of really work together and bring that.
Well, I think now would probably be a good time for us to loop Peter back into the discussion, because obviously we're all here today to chat a little bit more about the interplay between art and architecture. And Peter, before we kind of go into that in more detail, if someone was to Google you now and find out a little bit more about kind of who you are and what it is you've been up to, you know, they'd see that you designed, you know, museums, or you've sat down with Soho House to talk about, you know, brutalist architecture, and you've got kind of a wealth of experience designing spaces for, you know, cultural institutions or those within the arts, which is, you know, obviously you designed Rana's home. But do you want to maybe tell us a little bit more about you and what it is you do and how you got to where you are today?
How I got where I am today sounds very grand. How I literally got where I am today in Wales is coming off a train and cycling up a mountain, which is quite nice. So I'm here in a teaching capacity. I'm an architect, but I do get involved with different universities teaching architecture. I have spent quite a lot of time in the US, although I'm from the UK, and now I'm back more in the UK. But as a result, I think I have, a culture that exists across both countries. And so I have a practice that has probably got, although it's not a large or, sort of set up, a large infrastructure, it's got tentacles in different avenues. But I suppose going back to the original question, I worked in offices that in various cultural settings, one distinctly architectural and one distinctly landscape. And I think those both had an effect on my personal trajectory. But there is a continual echo of either cultural projects or clients that are deeply embedded in certain cultures, let's say.
I just think it's really interesting because I don't know about everyone else listening to the podcast, but when I think of an architect, I, automatically just go to the more residential, extensions that people do to their homes, or, if I think more broadly, I'd go to grand designs kind of territory. But you don't necessarily think of people that, are behind designing places like museums and public institutions, and that's actually a fascinating area of architecture that I haven't even considered until we started to have conversations about coming on the podcast. Would you say they're the kind of typical projects that you're dealing with?
Typically, I think it's more in a sort of hybrid setting, but the larger projects are much more I would say a kind of cultural forum. So either in a classic way, like a museum or an arts organization that is bringing people in to understand a particular presentation of art or art communities. I've recently worked on a large project in Memphis, for example, that was that, but it also was art residencies and providing facilities for the local community to be able to make art and film and music. And so, quite often I think the programs aren't absolutely, sort of distinct to say like the classic museum thing. And even actually, if you think of a museum, they tend to be quite hybridized programs that have cafes and libraries and conservation departments as well as exhibition anyway. So another project, a large project that I'm working on is really looking at a city as a cultural and physical trail, but partly reinterpreted through public art, for example. So that's a cultural and civic project. It doesn't have enclosed space in a classic way as part of that, but it has architectural moments and suggestions. So I'm not trying to avoid committing, but I just have a practice that is across quite different scales and maybe different types of clients.
One of which was obviously Rana, because you designed her new home. But Rana, I'm interested from your point of view, have you kind of always been interested in architecture as well as art, or was that kind of something that maybe developed later on in your practice?
Yeah. I mean, I've always been interested in architecture, and that's kind of come through, drawing and looking at spaces and working with my hand physically with material, and it's through the interest of material and looking that that kind of connection has been built up. But I think generally now everyone is interested, doesn't matter what discipline you're in, is interested in each other, interested in having conversation and dialogue and opening, up doors for collaboration. And I think, it's a really good thing. And I think it's great if it can continue, because I think we can all benefit from that. And I'm excited. I feel like as an artist, we shouldn't be pigeonholing ourselves and we shouldn't be kind of putting up walls.
No, definitely. And I think something that's interesting is obviously that you and Peter recently sat down at the Pitshanger Manor and had a very similar conversation to the one that we're having today around how architecture can influence art and vice versa. But I wonder, are either of you able to tell us a little bit more about what that conversation entailed for those of, you know, us that weren't able to make it?
That conversation, I felt, was really important because it kind of really informs the kind of dialogue that I have, you know, when I'm working or collaborating with someone. And it felt very collaborative, you know, even though this building that Peter has designed, it's his baby and it's his thing, and I really did hand over. I was very much a client. I thought it would be another opportunity to really open up our conversations that we were having.
I think kind of that's what's nice about also the experience that you and Peter have had when designing kind of your home, because it hasn't been, I guess, the standard architect client kind of working relationship, in the sense that the project's been done and completed in a very short space of time, and it's been a very standard build, because, you know, from the pictures I've seen, it's anything but that. But are you able to tell us a little bit more about kind of how you found working with Peter and the design process, and how it was that, you know, Peter helped you to create your dream home that is, you know, quite architecturally groundbreaking, I guess?
I really liked his approach as well. He spent a lot of time with me and my children and observing how I work in my studio. So I used to live and work on the site before it was demolished. And so he kind of observed how my children were in the space and how they really needed me to kind of separate my work and living space. And then he observed how I worked with my team when I had the studio in Haringey, and that was on two levels, which meant that we were really organized and were more efficient, and we were able to kind of really function as a team as well.
Yeah, I think that's very important.
I think that was really helpful for me, and it was really interesting for us to have that conversation, especially after, you know, having finished the development after 10 years. It took us 10 years from purchase to planning to demolition to development.
God, 10 years, it's terrifying. What a labor of love.
It definitely is. And so the building, actually, the way it's designed, it has a living and as well as workspace. So as you come into the mews, it's really discreet. It's right at the back of the mews, and it kind of, the space is slightly L-shaped. So you walk underneath a building, and you're kind of faced with the entrance, which splits, either goes into the studio or goes up into the flat. And the studio is on the two level. On the first level, on the ground level, is two studio spaces with a spray booth and an office. And we, you know, we need space to document and create work, but we also need space to make work that is, you know, isn't very dusty, and we can keep clean and stuff like that. So, and then the basement has become more kind of, you know, dusty kind of storage space.
I mean, it's a pretty special space though when you look at it. But Peter, from your point of view as the person who obviously designed the space, what's kind of your perspective on the build? And obviously 10 years, as Rana mentioned, is, well, it seems like an extremely long time, but I don't know the intricacies of what was involved. Are you able to share a little bit more about kind of how you experienced the build on your side as architect rather than the client?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, first of all, that time issue, let's say, the 10-year time issue, because I'm sure that sounds horrifying to a lot of people listening too. And you sort of think, oh my God, did it take 10 years to build it? We're talking about a 10-year process that has very intense periods, and then probably quite long periods where, you know, maybe Rana and I weren't even particularly in contact because, you know, she was going away and building her career. Partly, you know, that was required in order to be able to move to next stages of design, you know, say in economic terms, but also in knowing what the design should be, and then to a point where I could actually really seriously consider construction, because it was, you know, a sort of fairly ambitious project, maybe for anybody, because we were really pushing the site. I would say we were pushing the site to its maximum, given that it doesn't have very easy access, so that makes things tricky for construction. It has lots of neighbours, 12 party wall awards, meaning you've got 12 neighbours to negotiate with, which is a huge number. You know, you might normally think of two or three maybe in London, but 12 is a bit crazy. And also there were not many places you could even have windows because there were so many neighbours.
See, that's surprising though, because you look at the building and especially from the interior, it's so light and bright, and I certainly thought there were windows everywhere. You've got those huge expanses of glass in the kitchen and coming in through the ceiling. You've got light flooding in kind of from all angles.
So a lot of the light is actually, I'm not sure it's totally obvious, because I don't know, I think one just sort of experiences and absorbs light. You don't necessarily try and work out exactly where it's coming from if there's plenty of it. but a lot of the light is coming from above, and even in the rooms where we could have windows, which are those massive windows onto the cemetery, the beautiful view to the east, Abney Park Cemetery, because it's so thick with trees, weirdly there's not that much light coming from those big windows, and it's the few roof lights that are around that space that I think give the very, you know, clear sense of, or let's say a sense of very clean light that pervades. And when you get sunlight into the space, it's typically coming from those roof lights, because as I said, the big windows are actually facing east. So there are a lot of tricks. I think we almost talk about a project like that, the architectural enclosure or envelope is another way it's described. It almost defines a sort of light instrument. You can imagine a box on a table where you cut holes in, you know, at the sides and above, and shine lights through, you know, from the outside. You would have a box, you would be able to look into a box that was a sort of instrument of light, like looking at light physics in a way. And I think a project like that, to me, it feels like of course, it looks like a house in some ways, and it's got all sorts of other things in it, like kitchens or beds or toilets. But on a, if you sort of close your eyes and imagine it, hopefully you can understand what I mean. It's almost like a sort of receptacle for light, because if you imagine you cut holes in the right places with a scalpel knife into a box and then put it outside in the sun, you would see during the day that light falls in different ways, sunlight arrives in different ways, diffuse light affects the space in different ways. And I think you have to approach a building like that in that way, rather than what a conventional, you know, any conventional building looks like, but particularly not what you imagine a conventional house might look like.
And how did you find working with Rana? I know obviously we've got Rana with us today, but I more mean in the sense that obviously Rana is so kind of acclaimed within her field of being an artist, and obviously has that interplay with architecture, you know, more prominently now, especially more recently. But how did that work? Because I can imagine you both had quite strong, you know, creative views or quite strong visions of how you wanted the space to look like. And I can't imagine that was the typical kind of architect-client relationship.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've talked to Rana about this before, but often a client who's less architecturally, what would you call it, minded, would push and to be involved more. I think actually the way it worked quite well was I could very clearly see Rana as her, you know, as her artist self. And I think she could very clearly see me as my architectural self. And so we I mean, I understood by observing how she worked, what her sort of practical needs were, if you like. And also, she came to visit one project of mine that was quite a small, very compact flat in London where everything was very sort of packed away. Everything was spoken for in terms of storage space. And it meant that the surfaces were very calm and everything felt like it flowed together. And I know, I think as an architect, you observe how clients or potential clients respond to decisions you've made, and that guides you. And so I could tell, one, what she needed to work. I've learned more and more what she needed also to live, because Irana always mentions that I'd spent a lot of time working in amongst them, so I could observe. But also, the kind I grew to know the sort of things she liked in terms of existing within different architectural spaces. It wasn't like we collaborated and sat there trying to, come up with designs together at all. I mean, I would present designs. I think she was good at understanding, presentations, because she does have a spatial, strong spatial awareness and ability to understand, which is quite complicated often for clients, because they might look at a drawing or even a sort of rendered view of a space, and I'm quite often surprised with how they're interpreting that compared to what I'm expecting they will see, because I already know, I know all the spaces three-dimensionally in my head. And when I'm putting a render out to like a view out of it, it's purely to sort of try and explain what I already know to someone else. And so there is really a lot of space for misinterpretation. So I think it was quite straightforward with Rana, and understanding what we would present, and then adjustments that would be required as a result. But that aspect of the process, I think, was very straightforward, clean, and sort of respectful in terms of the role. So, and also, I just think we had an affinity in terms of what the kind of architecture that, I like to make and she liked to experience. I do think that was quite, you could feel that quite strongly. And that's not always the case, So that, having said that, she had some surprises when it was, when more and more was getting unveiled and scaffolding coming off. I mean, good, nice surprises. But the exterior of the building is quite sculptural. It's subtle, but it's quite sculptural. There are no vertical or horizontal faces on the exterior of the building. It's all sort of gently slanted with what I describe as pleats, where two inclined planes join. It's a bit like you will see in a shirt. To get the shapes you need, you have to cut the fabric and make a clean seam. And so, although we had presented, we didn't do that initially. Initially, and that's kind of the way I work. I work quite from the inside and get the volumes right, and then start to adjust the facade and the massing to get the sort of identity of the building from the outside. It's all, again, a bit like let's say clothing, or applying clothes, let's say, to a body, because then a new identity or an extra level of identity arrives. And so she was very much part of that process, where at one point we were presenting almost a sort of rectilinear pair of forms, because it's essentially two masses joined by a bridge. So we were presenting quite sort of two block forms. And then there was a process of, in three dimensions and on quite pure drawings, of just, us going away and almost like shearing pieces off to get these canted forms. And I remember distinctly when I came back and presented that to Rana, and she just immediately felt that and said, "Oh, wow, this is really great." And it wasn't an easy thing to pull off, because to get those sloped surfaces, it meant that the wall makeup had to have the ability to angle the supports for that outside wall. So it made it a very non-standing, let's say, a custom building. And so Rana knew that, and she, because that's the kind of thing that can also get cut from a project, when you get to a stage with the contractors, oh, that's going to be a lot of hassle because then we've got to cut all these things. And it is. I mean, it's true. It is more work, a lot more work. There's got to be a lot of planning for that. Anyway, she never, entertained cutting that back. So I think she had a sense that something special was coming. But I do remember distinctly when the scaffolding came off the building, she actually cried because she was so pleasantly surprised to see how all those quite subtly sculpted forms came together. And I think that's another example, going back to your earlier question, about not exactly designing something together, but knowing that as two people, you have in your own person, deep down your own person, you have a shared affinity for certain, I don't know if you'd say forms or experiences. And so I know she feels that that sort of slightly folded, you could call it, or adjusted or sculpted facade sits well with her work. And I've done that in. I've done that approach of taking a sort of rectilinear form and then carving back at it to lighten it and loosen it and find a sort of, as I said, identity in other projects. But I just think there was a real resonance there in that one because of the work that she
I
does.
think that's what works so well, though, is because the space is multi-purpose, it also has to kind of act as a gallery in some ways. And it does display Rana's work in literally, I guess, the best possible light. But I think one thing that I guess we're kind of coming to from this conversation is the kind of role that architecture has in potentially supporting or showcasing, artwork, but also the fact that art can feel very different within different environments, and getting those environments just right is, equally important.
From my side, I would, this is how Rana's work is Rana's, person. It's her identity, it's her character, and it's a very, very clear track, that she's on. And I think that one wants to, step back and observe that and find out, how you can be supported, but not exactly interrogated. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, definitely it does.
For me, working around art and the arts, let's say, but also we haven't really talked about that, or maybe we have just a tiny bit in terms of this view to the cemetery. I feel that art and nature are what one needs to bring in with the architectural discussion. So, and then people, moving through spaces and sort of carrying the sense of those disciplines with them. I mean, it's talking about a richness of experience, which I think in the end creates calm as well. It sounds like maybe that could be, layering something too much that wouldn't be calm, but I feel in the end, if you can achieve architectural spaces that have got enough identity to show you art or show you nature or let nature permeate, but also in their own right have a, I keep using this word identity, but a bit like they are one of the characters in the scenario. So if there are several characters at play, the architecture, I think should be one. I feel like personally, I'm not that interested in a concept of a sort of neutral, totally neutral space, let's say for art, but partly because I don't really think the spaces that are generally termed that are neutral. They just became seen as a an acceptable and quite known sound. You know, I'm talking about the sort of white box that's lit in a certain way from the top and is not apparently sort of pushing back. But I think that's such a very distinct and space in the end that I just mean myself as the architect, I want to find, and it sounds maybe boring, but I want to find the balance where the architecture is pushing back a little bit too, but in the end allows something really magical to happen between the different ingredients. So let's say again, the people moving through between the different essential practices they have, but then coinciding with unexpected, you know, unexpected elements that could be nature or art or sometimes music, and light and air. I'm sure it sounds quite obvious in a sense, but I think it's quite a trick to get the balance right.
I think that's a really good point, actually. And Rana, I'm interested from your side. Obviously, you've got your show on at Pitshanger Manor at the moment, and that space was obviously so iconically designed by Sir John Soane. But how did you find his architectural designs influenced, you know, the work that you created for that space, or that you even chose to show within the exhibition there?
Yeah, Pitshanger Gallery and Manor is a space that I've known about for a long time, actually, since I was a student doing my master's. And I remember visiting there quite early on and just being in love with the space, you know, the spaces that Soane has created, and particularly because he really uses light as a, almost like a material, as a tool to kind of activate a space. And it's beautiful the way he can, you know, let light kind of seep into spaces that you wouldn't normally kind of see. So to respond to the space was really a great opportunity. And, you know, what was amazing, the show at Mead Gallery, which was kind of really was site specific, I was responding to the new space at Mead and creating works that really fitted that space. And what I loved was the challenge of then seeing, you know, existing works then adapt to fit the gallery and the manor.
It's interesting, we often talk about architecture being a support or a backdrop, which I think is appropriate, and then maybe forming the, or you could call it a frame for art to exist or to be exuberant or to resonate or whatever. And I think that's true. And then sometimes the art is doing a job in informing the architecture or guiding you between spaces, or it's doing a job, and this particularly happens in Rana's work, at delivering light from one area to another via an extraordinary physical format. So I always say, when you think of light, or say if you think of colored light, I mean, our tendency is to think that's because there's an object over there that is that color. But I try and encourage people to think, well, the reason you're seeing Rana's fluorescent coral slither is because that light has made its way all the way across the room to your eyeball. And I think if the work is quite physical or sculptural, then it is, in a sense, architectural, if you describe architecture as a manipulation of light and a way of moderating your experience through space. So I think there's something quite interesting there too, that the art actually is transformative to your experience of the room. So recently, you know, we had the talk at Pitshanger, and I think because that is a series of architectural spaces that are at a level of sophistication, there is a really interesting conversation where sometimes the artwork, Rana's artwork I'm particularly talking about, dominates, and sometimes it is more of a clue, and sometimes it's outside in the landscape where maybe the landscape is the sort of broader in scale, and sometimes it might be a smaller room where the room then, in a sense, has to die away. And I just think that's brilliant. If you can find systems where it's sort of one's dominating and then the other. But it does rely, I think, on quite a particular type of architecture. I don't mean a particular look, but it has to be, I suppose, again, this, sorry to use it again, the identity, but it does have to have enough of identity. And then I think it has to have enough permeability to allow for some of those occurrences that I'm mentioning to happen.
Yeah, I don't suppose I've looked at it like that, but I think it's a good point. Rana, I guess at this point, it would be silly of us not to actually ask what is on show at Pitshanger at the moment, because I know your show, which we should probably mention, called Dappled Light, is on through to the 11th of September. But if our listeners were able to take a look and go and visit the Pitshanger before then, are you able to tell us what they can expect, or almost give them a little bit of a guided tour?
Yeah, so the as you kind of enter the Pitshanger Manor and Gallery, Outdoors is a work number 814, which is a piece of work kind of made up of toughened coloured glass panels that kind of jut out of the floor. And these glass panels are kind of parallel to each other, but slightly kind of shifting away from each other. And as the kind of the sun rises and sun sets, you get light seeping through the work and reflecting onto the floor. So you get coloured shadows on the floor. And this was a work that I made in 2018. And it kind of really makes sense, you know, to be part of that show. And then as you enter the gallery, on your right hand side, you'd see a work that I started in 2020, which consists of fingerprints. And the fingerprints are made up of kind of myself and some students that are able to kind of come and help. And they are, you know, this is a series of work that I've been kind of developing over the years as a response to my experience that I had in Bangladesh, which, you know, was basically my father had left some land that he was kind of donating back to the community. And in order to do that, we as siblings had to go to Bangladesh and sign the paperwork, but also put our thumbprints. And when I went to the registry office to put our thumbprints on, the entire registry office was covered by fingerprint. And that was a kind of a really, I mean, that experience in itself was amazing and incredible and really moving. But what I also loved was this kind of connection with architecture and land, you know, so there was kind of this immediate physical connection with architecture, and you had this movement of fingerprints across the wall, and it was kind of recreating that movement with the piece at Pitshanger. And then as you enter the gallery, you're having to kind of engage with this cloud that is suspended under the skylight, the central skylight of the gallery. And that skylight has stained glass glazing, and so the cloud is kind of suspended under, and so in certain lights the colors almost disappear, but as you walk around the space the colors appear. And so this cloud kind of forces you to kind of move around the space and really experience light in its various form, if you like. And then in that gallery, you have other body of work that really reflect kind of, I guess, my studies in response to light. So there's a kind of mirrored tile piece that's on the right-hand side that's really reflective, and it's, you know, it's kind of mirroring the space, but in a fractured way. And I love that as you walk through the space, you really see, sometimes you see yourself in the piece, but broken up. And then, you know, there are other works. There's a work that I made during my residency in Istanbul using dyes for lampshade bases. And again, you would have no idea what this is for, but when I was doing that residency and I was asked to pick to work with a workshop, I picked this particular workshop that had these dyes along the wall, the entire wall covered. And it almost felt like it was a city kind of reflected in these kind of form. And so for me, there was kind of bringing in this other element into this exhibition. And then in the manor, you've also got some reflector towers in the conservatory. And, you know, the conservatory brings in a lot of light. So you really experience them, you know, these towers kind of really glowing. And the other two works are fishing net, which is suspended within the stairwell of the manor. And that, I feel, really captures the light that Soane brings into the space beautifully. And then there's a film. It's my first film that I'm showing. And the film consists of photographs that are taken over a period of time that really shows the change of light throughout the year.
I think it sounds like a great show. And I know we've got the late summer party happening at the Pitsangan Manor in September, I think it is. But hopefully I'll get a chance to go have a look at the show before then, because it definitely sounds like it's worth a visit. And again, for our listeners, the latest show by Rana Bagum, Dappled Light, is on show at the Pitsangan Museum right through until the 11th of September. So make sure to pay it a visit. But honestly, guys, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. I'm conscious, Peter, that you've got to get back to teaching your students and taking them on their tour around Snowdonia. And Rana, I'm sure you're a very busy woman as too, but we really do appreciate you both taking the time out to chat with us today. It's been a really interesting discussion.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, James.
No problem. Well, that should just about conclude us for the latest episode of Temporary Admission. If you liked today's episode, obviously make sure to hit like, subscribe, or follow. We really do appreciate it, and it does make all the difference. Make sure to tune in next week, where we'll be chatting all things NFTs. Until then, stay safe. Speak soon.
It's happening daily. We're being conned by the institutions we used to trust. The mainstream media is distracting us with meaningless headlines instead of focusing on the harsh realities facing American families. Time is short before something big happens, and that's why so many folks are preparing. They're becoming self-reliant by investing in emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and secure 4-week emergency food kits for each member of your family. Each kit contains tasty breakfasts, lunches, and dinners, averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Save $50 on each 4-week food kit you purchase. Plus, get free shipping on Ready Hour 4-week emergency food kits. You're not ready if it's not Ready Hour foods. At My Patriot Supply, you can also get solar power generators, water filtration units, heirloom seeds, and survival gear. Order by 3 p.m., and your unmarked boxes ship the same day. Shop MyPatriotSupply.com today. MyPatriotSupply.com.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.